The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of the best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, Mountjoy Jail Governor Eddie Mullins came in to tell me about a novel but intriguing initiative that could see the number of re-offenders in Irish society and therefore victims of crime dramatically reduced. Former Great British Bake Off winner John Waite spoke to me about staying true to yourself, how the fame game is all nonsense, and the happiness he has found in simplicity. Heiress to the Abracababra throne, Roz Beer recounted the terrifying ordeal that her family experienced when they found themselves staring down the barrel of a gun held by one of the most notorious criminals in Irish history. The Hiding Game is a new book from Dublin author Louise Phillips. She joined me in studio to remember the little brother and sister that she never got to know and to explore how one of the most notorious court cases in recent history inspired her latest novel. And ahead of his star turn as Teen Angel in the upcoming Dublin production of Grease, Peter Andre dropped in to share his positive and thoroughly infectious outlook on life with all of us. And so that's it for this week. Hope you enjoy it. Until next time, thank you for listening. 51551 is the text number at 9:33. Glitter is banned from our house, is a text over the past 2 years, simply because it's a nuisance to clean up. Another says conifers are another crop that needs to be native trees for biodiversity or it's pointless. And more in on different things. We'll get to them in a few minutes' time. But I want to welcome the governor of Mountjoy Prison, Eddie Mullins. Good morning, Eddie.
Good morning, Ryan. Thank you
nice
for having
to see you
on.
Again. We spoke before with Philly.
That's right.
Philly McMahon on the Late Late Show. But here we are this morning. You've been very busy, ma'am. I was watching your TED talk that you did. How was it for you?
Oh, it was a great experience, Ryan. I suppose it was the first time we had a TED talk in an Irish prison. So it was very unique. Yeah. I mean, prisons are mundane, to say the least. So to bring a number of guests in to speak on a very important topic was really good. And we had a great audience of I suppose we'd call them influencers, who have... demonstrated their commitment to
your mission.
Our mission, exactly, which we're going to talk about, I suppose, in a couple of minutes.
It's funny when you say influencers, you weren't talking to makeup artists and bloggers like
not
you mean people of influence.
Absolutely, people of influence. Yeah, okay. Sure.
Let's talk about Mountjoy Prison for a moment as a physical structure.
Okay.
And the reason I want to talk about it because I was, as you know, I didn't meet you there, but no. I was in there one day, but just by the by, because I wanted to see what it was like. My grandfather spent some time there and I was fascinated. There's a little museum there that you can go to by appointment. Mm-hmm. And the walls, the Victorian element of it. Is it an anachronism of a building?
It's very unique, Ryan. I suppose it's three prisons within one. Really, we have accommodation for 700 prisoners. It has a medical unit where we have a drug treatment program, and we have a high support unit for prisoners with mental health issues. Mm. And then we have the main prison, which has about 500 prisoners in it. Very challenging environment, difficult place to work, difficult for staff. I mean, on any given day, staff can experience some severe aggression and violence and deep sadness and despair. So it's a really, really challenging place. And sometimes I think the prison service is the forgotten public service. I think back to the recent weather events in 2018. I know several hundred prison staff made their way in treacherous conditions into prison to ensure that the service was maintained. I know in Mountjoy alone, dozens stayed for a 30-hour period while the weather was at its worst. And sometimes I think there is a lack of recognition among the public for the service we do. It is a very difficult and challenging place to work and to live. And as I say, we look after some of the most challenging and vulnerable people in society.
I always think it's fascinating when somebody like yourself, the governor, comes in to talk to us here on this programme or on the station. And the audience tends to get riled up and divided 50-50 between, dare I say it, right wing, left wing, right? Mm-hmm. You know where I'm going with this.
Indeed, yeah.
So half of them are saying, lock them up. If you steal, you pay the price. If you do drugs, if you deal drugs, you get the hell behind bars and, you know, hair shirt. And mm-hmm. the other half go, well, if they have to, you know, understand where they're coming from, that they're committing a crime for a reason, that they're probably, you know, you just mind them, nurture them and bring them out and try and make them. It's an age old argument.
Absolutely. Well, I suppose, Ryan, if you look at the population in prison, there are quite a significant number of prisoners who have no interest in rehabilitation, who make serious money out of crime. They will come into prison and do their time and go back out and resume their criminal activities. But those people also recruit vulnerable people in prison. Prison is a place where they will use vulnerable men and women. They'll entice them into crime through promise of a good lifestyle or fast cars, money, drugs. And once they suck these people into the criminal world, it's almost impossible for them to get away from it.
Yeah.
So, yes, absolutely, there are people in prison that should be in prison that have no interest in rehabilitation. But there are also an awful lot of people who are in prison who are, and dare I say the word, victims of circumstances. They come from communities where opportunities have been lacking. And you say employment is a big one. The lack of employment leads to inactivity. People are drawn into the wrong type of behaviour.
So if you say they are victims of their background, if you like, and yet they say perpetrate a crime on somebody else who then becomes a victim of the crime and is violated by that, it's a terrible cycle.
Absolutely. And, you know, the last thing we would want to do in the prison service is to add to the pain and misery of a person who has suffered at the hands of a criminal. And but I do believe, you know, if you are to break that cycle, you know, we have to intervene and take people and give them opportunities that take them away from crime. We won't solve all the problems of the world. We certainly won't. There are people, as I say, who have no interest in turning away from crime.
Yes.
But there are a lot of people in the system who are, you know, given the right opportunities and supports. And, you know, the whole notion of rehabilitation, I would describe rehabilitation really as a recovery program. Mm. So in the prison service, for example, we have a lot of programs to deal with addiction, to deal with mental health issues. We provide fantastic education and training programs. But that's really only the start of it. You know, when prisoners leave prison, and almost all prisoners will leave prison at some stage, then it's really over to society to step in and to continue with that rehabilitation and recovery program. And a lot of prisoners will tell you when they leave prison that, you know, they feel ostracised. They feel that they are not welcome back.
Stigmatised,
yeah. Totally. Yeah. And then so the natural progression for these guys is back to the people that they feel comfortable with, yeah, who welcomed them back. So it's a really vicious circle. So it's so important that society, you know, the prison service and the probation service will do fulfil a particular role, and we will do our job to try and help people. But society in general, employers, you know, communities have a responsibility to continue on with the rehabilitation and recovery programme when people leave.
If you look at it like almost a caste system in the prisoners scenario, where you have one group who are the guys you saw, the hardened heads who come in because they got caught, mm-hmm, and they have no intention of doing anything else when they get out. In fact, they're probably still doing stuff from in there. That's one. Two then, just from extrapolating from what you're,
sure,
saying. Two, say the guys on drugs, they can't get off them, won't get off them, just are stuck in that drug mire forever and ever. And then three, which I think is the one you're talking about mostly, which is the group who got caught up in it and would love to be anywhere else but in that.
Absolutely.
What sort of percentage wise would you say that those three categories could be in
okay, well,
prison?
If I look at the Mountjoy, we'll take Mountjoy just as a single entity.
Is it a fair characterisation, by
absolutely,
the way?
Absolutely, it, okay, is. If we look at Mountjoy, I would say we've a capacity for 700 prisoners, and of that 700, there are probably 200 prisoners who, in my view, with interventions today, could go on the straight and narrow pretty quickly. And I'm simplifying that by saying,
of course, yeah, no, we're just a little,
but equally, like, it's a bit more complex and a bit more challenging.
Of course it is, of course.
Mental health issues are a big thing, and you mentioned drugs, Ryan, and the reality is I don't think there are many people that want to stay on drugs. Okay, the difficulty is getting off the drugs. And if you come from a background where you can buy drugs and you can support your own drugs habit, you probably won't come to the attention of the Gardaí, and you probably won't come to the attention of the prison system. It's the guys who are chronically addicted but cannot afford to support that habit. Mm. And these guys will become involved in petty crime and shoplifting, whatever it might be, to support that habit. My own personal view is I think these guys are really victims, because what's the difference between a middle-class guy who takes drugs and a guy from a poorer background who can't afford to take drugs but takes drugs? The only difference is they can afford to buy it.
I couldn't agree with you more. So how many of you did 200, said you
said? No, that's a rough guess.
Yeah, but look, this is all rough because there's nuance here. I totally get that. But just for the purpose of our chat this morning, how many people would you say are in Mountjoy, roughly speaking, who are into and on drugs?
Well, statistically, we'd say over 70% of the prison population are habitual drug users.
So that number-wise, out of 700, you'd be looking at about
Do your sums quicker.
500 plus there.
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
that's a huge amount of number. Yes. Now, how many of those 500 plus would you say are middle-class people?
Oh, I would say if you could count on two hands the amount of people in prison that are middle-class.
No, but that's without drugs, just all told.
Yeah, all told.
So out of 700, let's call it white collar, blue collar.
Okay, well, I can think in the last year, I can think of two people who I met coming into prison who were from a middle class background and the crime was drug related. They're the only two that can come to mind.
And how many people out of the 700 roughly in Mountjoy prison would you say characterise as middle class?
I would say 96% of the prison population statistically would say come from a poorer background. So 4% of the prison population are middle class. And you have to look into the context of sex offenders, for example, will make up a certain percentage of the prison population. And sex offenders are from all backgrounds. I won't stigmatise middle class. But
we shouldn't be laughing,
no,
but I know
no.
what you're saying.
Yes,
it is drugs, sex offenders, that kind of thing. But that's where you'll find them.
You'll probably find the majority are in that category. Yes.
96% versus 4%. Yeah. What are we to make of that, of those figures?
Well, look, I suppose we look back. It's not a new problem. Poorer backgrounds have suffered disproportionately from lack of investment, lack of opportunity,
education,
and we are reaping the rewards of that now. And I mean, it's a problem that will take time to resolve. But like events like the today's event, for example, that we're having a conference or a workshop, we'll call it, with employers. We've approximately 40 employers from various sectors. So we're looking at the likes of hospitality, construction, retail and service industries. And a lot of really big players in those sectors are coming today to this workshop. It's being hosted by IBEC, which in itself is a huge, huge departure. IBEC traditionally associated with big business, money, affluence. Danny McCoy is speaking at the event today, and he has really shown his support behind and really what we're doing is we're not looking for people to come and say, oh, we'll give this guy a job. We're looking to raise the awareness about how important employment is in breaking the cycle of criminal activity. And SULAS, for example, the State Education and Training Board, invest heavily in education and work training programs for offenders and for people in all aspects of society. But we're speaking specifically about prison. So, there are a lot of really good initiatives, good programs and a lot of goodwill out there to try and break this cycle. It will take time. And it will take a lot of commitment and a lot of perseverance.
So what's your dream in terms of employers and reformed prisoners? Is that a fair description?
Yeah.
What's your dream? I mean, let me just, before I ask, let you answer that, if you don't mind, the figures you say in your TED talk were just astonishing. 70% of the prisoners you have in Mountjoy have mental health issues. Mm-hmm. 70.
Now, mental health issues, Ryan, could be anxiety and depression right up to psychosis.
I understand. Yeah, sure. 80% have addiction issues. 80%. And 60% left school before the age of 15, even younger again. And then the figure which tallies with what you've been saying all morning to me here is that 96% of the population in prison come from disadvantaged communities. Yeah. I mean, it is astonishing. So why have IBEC decided, right, we need to talk about this. We need to bring prisoners back into society, give them a second go, reintegrate.
Okay, well, I suppose it started from the TED Talk and Danny McCoy couldn't make the TED Talk. So he had said he would like to come along. So we invited him into Mountjoy. We had a really good discussion. Danny had a tour of the prison. And I think when people tour the prison and they actually get a sense of, first of all, prisoners are very open. They'll talk to anybody that comes in. So, it isn't as daunting in some ways as people would expect. But and I suppose Danny McCoy is a practical man. I mean, the labour force, we're almost at full employment. So they're looking at various ways to attract people into the employment sectors. And certain sectors like hospitality struggle to retain people. So there's a practical side to it too. But I think to be fair to him and to be fair to IBEC, there's a social conscience in IBEC, which, believe it or not, if you dig deep, you'll find it. It's there. And they really are keen to help us in what way they can, in any way they can. And today, again, is about raising awareness. Ryan, I have to mention, there are a lot of really champions in the community. Nevin McGuire, for example, has continuously employed ex-offenders, got a lot of flack at times from it. Some of the red tops he did. Some of the red tops, you know, went to particularly to town on him in relation to the people he'd employed. Dominic Kemp, another entrepreneur, chef. Dominic is speaking at the event today. And you know, there are a lot of people like that who have really shown commitment and perseverance, because sometimes there is negative attention paid to, not sometimes, a lot of the time there's negative attention paid to prisoners and ex-prisoners and people that try to assist or try to get involved in rehabilitation programs often, you know, often experience some negative publicity that can adversely affect their business. So for somebody to step up to the plate and say, look, I'm quite prepared to give this guy a chance or to support a program, you know, is a brave step.
There's a guy in the UK you reference who is Timpson, Key Cutters. And is this your role model in terms of...
James Timpson, the IPRT, which is an advocacy group for prisoners, held a conference about 12 months ago, and James Timpson was the keynote speaker.
And who's he?
No, he's... Okay, so he's a very, very... affluent individual. His father would have been in the House of Lords, as far as I can recollect. So he would be a man of considerable means. Mm-hmm. His father was, I suppose, sometimes you don't have to scratch too far to see where these people get a social conscience.
Yes.
He told a story about his when he'd come down for breakfast in the morning. Very often there would be four or five children around the table having breakfast that he'd never met before. And his father and mother used to take in emergency children into emergency accommodations, you know, for fostering kind of thing.
Yes.
So that was probably where his social conscience came from. Timpson's a very big business. I think they've about 1,800 retail outlets, or maybe 18,000. I could be getting the figure wrong. In the UK, it's a service business. It's an area where people don't require deep skills, so they can work in retail and key cutting and so on. Mm. So James Timpson felt that, you know, they needed to intervene and support some good cause. And he worked with the UK Prison Service for quite a while. And they decided that they would introduce a programme of hiring ex-offenders. So he took 10 prisoners on. Again, probably rushed into it. Took the wrong 10 prisoners. They stole from him. They didn't turn up for work. They stole drugs in the shops, and it was a disaster.
The greatest fear of all the employers.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You better correct this story fast.
Absolutely. But I suppose the key here was that he persevered. And they went back to the prisons and they did a bit more research. And so, you know, planned it better than they did the first time, talked to the various people in the prisons, and decided then that what they would do is come into the prison and maybe train guys for 6 or 8 weeks before they were released, get to know them so there wasn't that barrier when they came back out. And today, 10% of the Timpson workforce are ex-offenders. And he would describe them as probably his best employees. And they've all gone up the ranks, and well, not them all, but a lot of them go up the ranks to retail managers. And he said they're a very trustworthy bunch. And the interesting thing about prisoners is, and again, I'm generalising here, but a lot of prisoners are quite honest and open. They will tell you, yeah, I've done this, I've done that, I have had addiction issues. Generally, they don't hold as many secrets. For example, if a guy goes in for a job into Timpson's, the information that the interviewer is going to get is very limited. Whereas with an ex-offender, he nearly gets all the information. It's all the background before the person goes in.
It's all there. So you're looking for Timpson's.
We're looking for Timpson
Irish
style.
Timpsons.
Absolutely.
To say, I presume they're all Garda vetted and there's checks. Like, I mean, everyone's Garda vetted nowadays
anyway. Absolutely. Well, it would really depend on the nature of the employment, how detailed the Garda vetting would be. But Ryan, I have to stress, we are looking for people like with the Timpson type model. But it isn't easy. People, you know, employers really need to know, when you take on an ex-offender who may have had issues and challenges in the past, it's about perseverance and it's about supporting these individuals when you take them on. And, you know, I think sometimes we tend to put prisoners into groups and take them into programs where ex-prisoners are on a particular program. But that keeps the stigma going. You know, so the prisoners are still in a group and they're a group of ex-prisoners. But what I would like to see is employers taking on 1, 2, 3 ex-offenders who blend in with the rest of the employees and are just employees. They're not ex-offenders working in an organisation. They're just employees.
Yes.
So, but it is important to realise that because of the nature of ex-offenders, it is a challenge at times, and they will need continued support, and sometimes they will fail, and we would hope that when they do fail that the employers will go again and say, look, that didn't work out, but we'll try again.
But big social conscience probably required, a leap of faith required.
Absolutely. But you know, if you even put it down to pound shillings and pence, it makes perfect sense.
Why, is it cheaper?
Well, if you can take one guy who leaves prison, give him employment, and that works out and he supports his family, you've broken that cycle there. Mm. And, you know, less criminals will mean less victims.
Everyone wins.
And I mean, that sounds very simple and you know, it's low.
No, but it's a nice domino effect.
But you know, let's try it. Let's see how it goes.
You mentioned in your TED Talk a film that we spoke about on this programme called Michael Inside.
Yes, yes.
And I think for anyone who hasn't been in prison, and as you rightly said, the only negative against it is that the governor is considered is portrayed as sullen and unpleasant.
Heartless.
They're not like that in real life, no. As we know. But I felt I got a great insight, mm-hmm. into the not only the mundane and pretty drab existence, because people say, oh, it's like a holiday camp in prison. Yeah, try it sometime, mm-hmm. as somebody once said. But also the cyclical nature, particularly that the main character, it was kind of an unfortunate scenario and just caught up in it all. It's a good reference point, I think, for people.
And you know, Ryan, it's true. And imprisonment has a huge effect both on the person that's in prison but on the wider family and community. And that film that you talk about, Michael Inside, demonstrated that. If you remember, his grandfather was put under untold pressure to pay a drugs debt. And the reality is, you know, if somebody owes something in prison, a drugs debt in prison, there is no mercy shown. Yeah. So that debt will be paid come hell or high water.
Necessarily the inmate.
By either the inmate or by outside. A family member. And I suppose criminals like the serious criminals we talk about, they exist on by fear and intimidation, and there is no mercy shown. So, you know, prison is a difficult place to be. And I can't, you know, I've said this numerous times. People talk about prison as a holiday camp. And I've seen comments where, you know, I remember recently a group of prisoners were given a Chinese takeaway and there was an outcry about the Chinese takeaway. You know, people are misguided when they think prison is an easy place. It is not an easy place. It is a very difficult place for both staff to work in and prisoners to live in.
No doubt. Sir John Timpson, Steve says, is primarily in the shoe repair business.
Yes, right.
Well, the key cutting, they all go hand in hand.
Diversified.
David says, I'm 40 years old and I'm 25 years using drugs. Over the years, I tried and tried to come off alcohol and cocaine and I failed. I'm 13 months clean this time and I'm delighted. I've enrolled to do an addiction course in Maynooth because I want to give back and try to help others now. It's great to hear you talking about this. Another says, I recently did the progression park run in Mountjoy and I went in with lots of preconceived notions and ideas but I left with a whole new attitude. The prisoners chatted to us about the usual park run stuff and times, etc. And the support from everyone was amazing. Councillor Niall Ring was on to say the local League of Ireland club Bohemians have a great association with Mountjoy through the Bohemian Foundation. Tommy Hines set this up and last year as Lord Mayor. I had first hand experience of the wonderful work it does. There's a prison, says another, overlooking Weymouth in UK with amazing views. And they have a cafe within the walls open to the public, operated by inmates. And they cook and serve the meals. Great initiative and worth a visit if anyone is in the area.
Well, Ryan, just on that, you mentioned our museum.
Yeah,
so we have relocated our museum to a new building. So
have
we're hoping you'll come along and have a look at it.
I definitely will.
And there's a coffee shop element to the museum as well. So it's external to the prison, but it really is a fascinating visit.
Well, maybe you will eat your own medicine and have the inmates involved in the food and catering.
It's
something in there.
Our staff mess is managed by staff and 10 prisoners. So we do have our prisoners cook for us every day.
Is that the loaf of bread I got from the
kitchen? No, that's from the bakery.
But they're staff.
Prisoners are fully involved in
all the catering.
Because
they came to have
the
chats there as well. So it is, you know, it's a work in progress, isn't it? Aren't we all?
Absolutely.
Eddie Mullins, great to see you again.
Thank you very much,
thanks for coming in to see us this morning. 51551. Please mention that the Matt Talbot Centre, Ballyfermot, Jesse Buckley, who we are great fans of here, doing a fundraiser gig in Vicar Street on September 25th. The centre do incredible work with the marginalised community. Happy to mention that at 9:58. It's 9:30. It's Tuesday morning. We are so happy you're with us this morning. 51551 is the text number. John Waite, good morning to you. Nice to talk to you.
Good morning. Nice to talk to you.
You are a former Great British Bake Off winner. How old were you when you entered the competition, John?
Oh, I was a little tiny thing. I was 23 and it was 7 years ago. So it feels like a lifetime ago.
I can imagine. But and at 23, what made you think, I know this program? It was only the third season, but it was still hugely popular. What made you think, I could do this? I can bake my way to success?
I don't know, I guess it was just youthful arrogance or maybe ambition, you know, unbridled, bold ambition. But I just enjoyed food and I enjoyed baking and I enjoyed the show. And so I just thought, why not go for it? You know, life is far too short not to give it a try. That's my motto. And luckily, it still is my motto. I'll do anything once.
Worth a go. And had you been a student before at 23? Had you got a degree or an education?
Well, I'd dropped out of university and started again. So I was like a late comer to university. So during the Bake Off finals, I was actually doing the finals of my law degree at the same time. So it was a pretty hectic few months for me. It was pretty crazy. But I managed to get through both.
Okay, and with that, that's very impressive, I might say, spinning two plates, if I may. But with that in mind, you were obviously recording the Great British Bake Off. Clearly, it's not live, but when do they put the programme together in advance of a broadcast?
So we started filming on Easter Friday, actually, in 2012.
Yeah.
So it was then 10 weeks every weekend from that date. So we probably wrapped in the middle of June, start of July. And then it was broadcast from August to October. So it's done about 3 months in advance.
And how was it for you as an experience?
I really enjoyed it. You know, a lot of the other bakers found it quite stressful. But I found it was a really great bit of time away from my degree and from the exams and from the grueling tasks of university. So I actually quite enjoyed going down to Bristol every weekend and having a little bit of time out. But it was after the Bake Off that it was tricky, you know. After you've won, you've got all these opportunities and stuff, and there's nobody there to hold your hand and help you.
Yes, and that is exactly the sort of line, I say that respectfully, that we've heard more recently from people who are involved in reality TV programmes. Let's call them the more slightly more glamorous, if you like, ones, whether it's Love Island or Big Brother,
yeah,
or whatever, versus what I would call the Bake Off as a much more wholesome affair. And yet it still puts you, John, as a winner back, and we're going back, as you say, to 2012, in a spotlight and a limelight, the likes of which you'd never experienced and could not possibly anticipate in terms of its wattage. So how did you deal with it and realise this is big?
I don't know. I guess I just had to sort of take it as it came to me. It was like one of those Japanese game shows where they're walking along a tightrope with people throwing pineapples at them. It was that kind of thing. I only could continue. I could only go forward. It was difficult because at such a young age, I was offered crazy amounts of money for book deals and for recipes and things like that. But it was very easy at 23 to get carried away with that kind of lifestyle. But luckily, I had my partner and I had a family who were very, very sensible, and they kept my feet on the ground. So, you know, I did have safeguarding and welfare in place. But the more glamorous reality TV shows like Love Island, I can only imagine that it really does go to the contestants' heads and they get carried away with it. Because why wouldn't they? You know, this whole new lifestyle just comes, is thrust upon them. And it's a complete change and escape from the regularity and mundanity of everyday life. And it's very, very, it's very addictive. It really is. So, you know, it's really important, I think, that TV production companies have a lot more safeguarding and aftercare for the contributors, because they make so much money from these people, the TV shows. You know, they make a lot of money. And the people who go on the shows, they might make a little bit, but they're not going to last around. They're not going to be around forever. So there has to be a much more welfare and much more duty of care than there currently is, I think.
And can you give us a sense of what happened for you in your head and your mind when the spotlight then hit you?
So when it first hit me, I was like a rabbit in the headlights. I was overwhelmed.
Sure.
And then I realised that, you know, just go for it. I always knew at the back of my mind that it was going to fade away, that the lustre of being a Bake Off winner would slowly fade, that afterglow would dim. But it was still not, that's not to say I didn't enjoy it, because I did. But as the workload started to die down, that's when you really think, oh gosh, what am I going to do now? Because, you know, I've got a mortgage now and I've got a lifestyle that I've become accustomed to.
Yeah.
So it's very easy to perhaps lose everything and lose your complete control. Luckily, I always saved half of everything for bills and for mortgage and all of that. I always saved half of everything I earned. So I guess it's important to approach it very sensibly if you can. But it's very overwhelming. It's just a complete shock to the system. You know, you go to parties and people of quite high caliber want to talk to you, and you've got to remember that it's not because of who you are, it's because of what you've done. And it's really quite a cynical way of looking at it, but I think if you look at it with cynical eyes,
you'll survive it. You know, you've got to be quite realistic about it. Don't get carried away.
That is such a salutary lesson to anyone of a certain vintage who would love it all. And I understand anyway from your past that you, every time you, it's, you've struck me as being like a homing pigeon. Every time you drifted too far from home, you drifted emotionally, dare I say it, and that you were always drawn back to family, friends, place.
That's so true. Yeah. Whether it was dropping out of university for the first time, you know, I went down south to university and I hated it, so I moved back up north. After the Bake Off, I moved to London and I realised that it's just not who I am. I'm a farmer's son. I'm a working class northern lad, and I'm proud of that. You know, and I want to be known for that. That's who I am. I'm not this glamorous celebrity who goes on all night benders. That's just not my cup of tea. I'd rather, you know, do a bit of gardening, play with the dog, and get an early night.
Yeah, but because you've spoke very frankly and you've written frankly about, you know, life as a youngster and trying to confront the vagaries of I suppose emotional kind of loss or at least upset. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Do you mean is in depression or
yes,
sort of post? Yeah, I mean I've always had depression and I've always struggled with the low mood. And for me, the only way of combating that without getting too involved in medication and all of that, not that that's a bad thing, but you know, it's each to his own. The only way for me personally to deal with that is to have a strong network of friends around me. And it's very, very difficult to be a depressive because, you know, there's not much known about it. You know, a lot of people still say, it's that old mantra, isn't it? I don't understand it. And, well, that's not an excuse anymore. I've had enough of that. If you don't understand something and you continue talking about it, then you're talking in ignorance, basically. So I think we are now in a time, luckily, where much more is being done to promote and publicise mental health and to get more help for people and to try and reform what is currently quite an ignorant view of it.
And that's where, you know, the whole idea of mental health has become much more talked about. And you would hope that certainly for your generation, if I could say that, you know, particularly with things like Instagram and Twitter online, essentially being a subplot to people's stories nowadays, you've got to mind yourself more and tread more carefully.
You do. You have to be careful. You have to be very careful of what you say, you know, and how you approach things, because there's always going to be someone who's easily offended in life. You know, we've always, I think forever we've experienced those people who get offended by, you know, by hello.
Anything, yes.
Anything. But at the same time, there are people with grave sensitivities out there who need to be approached delicately, and they deserve the respect that they deserve. So it's striking the right balance of you know, of speaking freely, but also having respect for fellow humanity.
It's the balance that seems to be what it's all about, John, with you, particularly when you think about now. You sound very content, very happy. You've got you kind of got your life together, and you can marry the Great British Bake Off experience and the success that lies with it, and also have a life of your own. And you, in other words, you can do both when you get it right.
Yeah, you can do both. And I think what I would say to the contestants of every year of Bake Off and even Love Island, whatever, the person you are or the person you were before the show is the best version of yourself. It's the person you're always meant to be. And that's what I think. Just be yourself. Don't try and change to try and fit into a celebrity lifestyle. Just be who you are. Be true to yourself.
Yes, the celebrity lifestyle is bullshit, isn't it?
Total bullshit. It's nonsense.
Yeah.
Basically, celebrities are just used by capitalist companies to sell soap powder. That's all it is.
Yeah, but if people had a taste of it, they'd realise it looks great. It should be great. You know, it's the opposite of the duck. It walks like a duck. It talks like it is. Sometimes it might walk. It's a bit like online. And you know, so many, not all, but most influencers. You know, you're peddling essentially stuff you'd like people to buy that you got for free.
Exactly. It's a load of crap.
There's an awful lot of it about, but that's why we have to break it down and tell it like you're doing today. Tell it what it is. That lovely line you just said there about being the best version of yourself is the one before you went and became a thing. So called.
Yeah, it's so true. You know, you are who you're meant to be, and just be content with that.
Now, how did you meet Paul?
Paul and I met on Facebook, actually.
Ah, after all that.
Yeah, I know social media can be.
No, you met through. You put the social in social media, John, let's face it.
Yeah, we met through friends, and we've just actually decided to get married after 11 years together. We're going to get married next year, which is exciting.
Next year, and the day?
We think it's going to be the 24th of October. It was going to be Halloween, but the venue we want is booked. So I'm either going to have to bump somebody off the mortal coil or just set up for a different day. I've not yet decided which path I'll take.
Great. But that's more happiness in your life. And you, I noticed you have a book as well.
Yeah, I think Keith again talks about the bloody book.
Flash in the pan, that's great, because that could describe fame, couldn't it?
Yeah, it's just simple. It is, and that was kind of why I wanted to write that book, because I wanted to use that title as well as a sort of subliminal message to people. It's all a flash in the pan, it's all nonsense. But also, good things can come out of that. You know, good things can come out of temporariness and transience, and this is the book for me. It's a quick and easy cookery book. Everything's cooked on the hob on the stovetop within 45 minutes, and the food's delicious as well.
I love an eaten mess, right? I think it's delicious. And you have rhubarb and matcha.
Yeah.
What's matcha? I don't know what matcha is.
Matcha is ceremonial green tea, so it's a very, very fine green tea. I think it almost tastes a bit like digestive biscuits.
Oh, that's good.
So it really marries well with the rhubarb. It's quite, it's got a very strong umami flavour to it, like, you know, a very mouth-filling feel. But it's used sparingly. It's delicious. It's a really good accompaniment to things like rhubarb and blackcurrant. So it's gorgeous.
And how about the coffee and cornflake French toast?
Oh, that speaks for itself, my boy.
It's
so good. Because, you know, French toast is nice, but it can sometimes be a bit soggy. So throw cornflakes in there and it's crispy, it's soggy, it's coffee flavoured. With maple syrup on top, it's absolute heaven. I think a few people have said that is the only way that they will make French toast now, is by putting cornflakes on the outside.
They'll never go back after this.
They'll never go back.
Tex said, great to hear John on the radio. He sounds like such a nice guy. And that's the way he came across on the show too. Loved watching him and James on the Bake Off that year. And it's not back on tonight, actually. Do you watch it, or is it kind of an old memory for you now, John?
No, I do watch it, but I watch it as a viewer now. For the first few years after Bake Off, it was very much, you know, I felt a little bit melancholy and a bit nostalgic for it. But now I've finally driven that wedge of distance in between me and the Bake Off to be able to enjoy it for what it is. And that's a TV show. You know, I'm no longer emotionally attached.
Yes, I understand entirely. And you, somebody, another text said, congratulations to John on getting married. Will he bake his own wedding cake?
I will, of course.
Will you? Can you give us an indication of what you're thinking? I mean,
well, because we're having a Halloween wedding and we're having it in an old monastery in Manchester,
great.
We're going to go for quite a spooky theme. So we're going to have a masquerade ball for the wedding, and we're getting married at twilight. So I'm going to do a very dark cake, a very black cake with skulls on there and stuff. So it won't be everyone's cup of tea, but screw everybody else, it's my wedding.
Well said, John. I like your style. Hey, it's been lovely talking to you. We'll see you back in Dublin sometime. If you're ever in town, call in to say hello.
Sure. All right. Thanks very much.
Thanks, John. Mind yourself. John Waite there, former Great British Bake Off winner, joining us on the line there for a little catch-up on his world. It's a very popular programme indeed. And as I say, it's the wholesome end of things, no doubt about it. But funny him saying he couldn't watch Great Britain. I can't watch chat shows, strangely. I can't. It just feels like double mats. I mean, I love doing it. We're back on Friday and it's exciting, but I actually can't watch. I can watch arc old ones. You know, so but I actually can't watch all the American, and yeah, it's just no. Talked about that another day. So that's that one. And what else did he say? There's loads of things we can come back to on that. 51551 is the text number. Rory's in Kerry, I should say, and he says, I animated some of the spiders in Harry Potter 2. How about that? And we studied them for several weeks. They are a marvel of engineering. A neuro center at each leg. They carry their torso at a constant level, no matter how rough the terrain. Besides, my mother told me, if you kill a spider, there'll be rain that day. And I can't prove her wrong there. I've heard that. That one I've definitely heard. Money in a card. This is from Michelle Power on the subject of money in a card for the Debs. It's not just about the Debs night out. I see it as a congratulations on getting through the last year in one piece, and good luck starting out on your career, etc. So, look, each to their own when it comes to these things. There's no law in the land to be worrying about. Right, 51551 is the text number at 14 minutes to 10.
The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. At 20 to 10, I want to introduce you now to Roz Beer. Good morning, Roz.
Good morning, Ryan.
Very nice to meet you.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for coming in to see us, because we have lots to talk about. We're going to talk about tea in a few minutes' time. But a little bit of background as to who you are and where you're from, and people will know the name. It's an unusual name, B-E-E-R-E.
Like the drink with an E in the end.
You've had
I'm
to
still
say that
doing
all
my
life.
Yeah. I'm not order a taxi with beer.
Got it.
Well, now we're on my taxi, it's fine.
It's changed that.
It's changed that.
Those phone calls are gone now.
Gone, yes.
Your family, your dad and your uncle set up Abracababra in 1982. Yes. For people who've never been inside one, who don't know what it is and who think it might be the word of a magician, what is Abracababra? And how is it such a gastronomic phenomenon in this country?
Well, I think just bring it back when it launched in 1982, you know, Ireland just had fish and chips. I did my PhD actually on franchising and fast food and real estate. But anyway,
great.
So basically, Abracababra is, it's now daytime and nighttime, but it's a place you can go and have an array of food. Kebabs were only had five things on the menu: a kebab, chips, burger, and now they've, you know, 50 items.
Everything
on the
you
everything,
want. Yeah.
You know, and they've got like falafels and everything, so they've gone very healthy. But back in the 80s, there was very little like it, and it was open late, and you could go in and sit in on like a chipper, and people could go in after the pub and have a kebab.
Yes.
You know, generally speaking, if you'd any incidents involving a kebab and drink, it was probably more the drink than the kebab.
I think that's a very fair point.
I had a lot of stories about that, so yeah.
And there'll be a lot of kebab-related dry cleaning incidents.
To be honest, I've never experienced them, but myself and my friends would go in, and again, it was just a place to go after being out in a night out. So it was a good place. And my uncle at the time was only 22, so he was really phenomenal. And my dad was 30, and my dad had been a chartered surveyor. He had three kids, and he then, for the first year they set up, it was kind of my uncle Graham's brainchild, and my dad went in as partner, and my dad was all about the leasing and all that stuff, and Graham was kind of, you know, the ideas person, and between the two of them they made a great team, and then they franchised out, and it became in the 80s and 90s it became the largest Irish owned franchise.
Great. It was the go-to post pub,
venue.
Place.
Yeah. Like, we would, as a family, call it Abra. And they've actually rejigged the name a little bit more to Abra and then the kebab. But at the time in 1982, there was the song Abracadabra. So people just still pronounce it Abracadabra, and we just...
Just smile.
It's like Rosalind Beer, or they're like Beer A or whatever. You just kind of go, oh yeah, that's fine.
But it did extremely well, and it tapped into a market, a kebab chomping nation we didn't know existed. And everything was going very well in that regard, because... you made lots of money, or your folks did, and it worked.
Yeah, it was very successful. I mean, I think the testimony to it was it was a cash business, but there was, at the time, there was no cash. You know, those night drops where they come in and take the cash out. So it was that kind of era of, there was a lot of people going in, spending their cash. They were opening shops. I remember distinctly, like, I remember at 6 years of age when it opened, I remember sitting around the dining room table, like the kitchen table, counting money for my, it was part of my chore. Like,
sure.
I didn't get my pocket money if I didn't, you know, and you're counting. And basically it was, like, how we knew it was successful as kids was just that people were like, oh, do you eat a kebab every night? And like I said to your producer, I've never had one. In my whole life. Or a steak. But I have had my first burger this year, but I eat chicken.
Congratulations.
I eat meat.
Okay.
So yeah, it was a big deal. I think I remember they got to 60 stores around Ireland, and it was really kind of a household name.
Yes.
And I mean, no one else around the world, apart from expats and Irish people, would know of it. But it started to launch into the UK, and then they ended up in Bahrain. And it's since still a family business. My uncle's still at the helm. My dad's retired. And my cousins are involved. I've written about it. I've gone from the inside out to the outside in. I lecture on it, on franchising, and I've written case studies on Abracababra. So I'm very proud of it.
Yeah.
And really, when I think as an adult, professional businesswoman with three kids, I really appreciate what they actually achieved.
Yes, of course.
You know, and it was quite phenomenal. And again, in 1982, depths of recession. You know, and my dad would have had a flashy car. We used to get him to park it 5 minutes down the road from school, and we'd like cringe walking up. We had a pool in the house, and we just pretend that we didn't. You know,
that's the Irish approach. Arnold Hanlon was here recently. He was talking about the Irish approach to wealth. You have to pretend you don't have it. Yeah.
No.
But you did have it, and it kind of got you into that bother in September in 1989.
30 years ago.
Yeah. You were very young at the time, weren't you?
I only realised my birthday is the 18th of this month. Happy birthday, me! I'm 43. I just turned 13. Like lucky, unlucky number 13.
You remember the time to the minute?
To the minute, because I was setting. So I was in my bedroom. Dad had gone out to check the shops, which is what he had to do, because back then there wasn't Security Corps and all these companies that did, you know, money drops. And basically he would go out like most nights to check the shops, or my uncle would. And, you know, that was kind of part of the life. And so I was setting I just started in secondary school, just turned 13, 9 days before. And I was setting my alarm clock for school the next morning, and it was 13 minutes past 11. It was still on my alarm clock the next morning. Yeah. So it forever that time, when I see it even on my watch today, sometimes it just, the other time it has a flicker back.
Of course.
So I was in my bedroom. My older brother was there. My younger brother was asleep. My mom was in her room. The dog had been barking earlier furiously. This dog was the friendliest dog you could ever, like, she'd lick anyone who came into the house. So my mom had to hush her in. But we didn't think anything of it. Mm-hmm. Setting my alarm clock, and the next second this figure appeared in my door, half in my door, with a gun and a balaclava, and beckoning me towards him. And I just said, "Dad, what are you doing?" And I think at the same time, because there was three armed robbers, one had gone to my mom, one had gone to my brother, my older brother, and they have their experiences of what happened. And I think my brother, older brother's, was the gun was put to his head, and it was like, "Get out." And my mom, there was panic buttons in her house that had been installed. We hadn't used them. We hadn't even got the alarm on, which was a bit, you know, when you think about it. I don't know if it would have made a difference. And the person who went into my mom was like, "This is for real. You know, are you dressed? Get out of bed." So the next second I was standing in my room, all the lights were turned off, the landing lights, all the curtains were closed. It suddenly was quite quiet. And then my brother was brought in under a sheet. And I just remember thinking, wow, OK, this is not a joke. And then, but it's all happening in nanoseconds, you know. So we get brought down to my parents' bedroom, and they had an ensuite bathroom. And then my mom was already sitting on the side bath, on the bath.
Sure.
And she had, who was the person in charge, beside her. So I sat beside, in between my mom and my brother. And then that's when it began. You know,
What began?
Just sitting there and just... The fear.
Like a tiger kidnapping almost, but you weren't taken out of the house,
no,
so you were kept in.
I wasn't, but there was a few moments.
The man talking to your mother?
Yeah, so he was.
So
my mom said to us, the way we viewed it afterwards was, weren't we so lucky? Weren't we so lucky that my dad wasn't there? Weren't we so lucky that we weren't taken?
Or killed?
But there was, well, I mean, that clearly went through my head a lot of times, or worse, and, you know. But there was moments where, there was moments of tension, whereby my brother and my mom were taken out separately to be questioned. I thought I was going to be next, and I was shaking, and I didn't know what they were doing with them, like where they were going, would they come back? But my mom throughout it all was incredibly calm, and she's an incredibly calm woman. And then the person who was kind of the main person was kind of chatting then, and this went on, like we were there for over two hours. We were there for 3 hours tied, you know, ultimately in the bathroom. It felt like forever, honestly. You know, I'll never forget it, you know, every second. And what was happening was the two younger guys were coming in and whispering, asking questions. So they'd found stuff. They'd found a gun that my dad had done some shooting, and I think he had it for protection. They took my mom out to ask a question about a safe in the basement. It was locked. Nothing was in it. I mean, these are the things that you don't want to be happening when you're having an armed robbery. And my mom was like, "Wayne has the gun. Oh my God. I told him to get rid of that thing." And because my mom was so annoyed about it, they just believed her.
Yes.
And my brother concurred the story, and then they didn't ask me.
Who was the man running this operation?
So, I mean, I know 100% the guards said at the time, because the general lived close by, grew up in Rathgar. He was up the road. He would commonly slash tyres of all the residents on Orwell Road and around the area, kind of just for the police to kind of tell them, you know, I'm here.
We're here.
And, you know, subsequently watching him being interviewed and his figure and who he is, I mean, it's not somebody that you would forget who they are and what they look like.
And you're certain it was the general that was in the bathroom,
you know,
that night?
I would swear anything on it, yes. It was, and just how he was, like, he made a joke. Now, when I say he made a joke, and there was a few jokes, that was, again, attributed to my mom being calm. I was shaking kind of a lot of the time.
She was kind of keeping
She was
him,
keeping very calm, yeah. And I was, basically, he made a joke about having to go up for work the next morning.
Did he?
And He's like, yeah, I'm a bit tired. Anyway, so what ultimately what happened was they tied us up with my dad's ties, gagged us, tied our hands behind our backs, our legs, and then said that we were going downstairs. We've got to check more of the house. And he wanted to go with the other two armed robbers. Mm-hmm. But it was calm, but the other two were frantic. And if he hadn't been in charge, I don't know.
Yes.
And if my mom hadn't been so calm and just answered the questions, or if my dad had arrived back, there's so many things.
A lot of what ifs.
Yeah, that you do go through in your head after. Mm. But we were, as I said, very lucky. So anyway, they left, tied us up, took the key out. And then about an hour later, my mom knew that my brother was asleep. My younger brother was asleep. She'd asked, and he was. He was only six. He would have been asleep. And my dog was knocked out. I was upset about my dog. Was she okay? And my dad arrived back, and just I'll never forget him opening the door of the bathroom and his face. And I remember thinking, "Wow, this is scary." Do you know? Like it was. It kind of hit me.
And we are.
And
free.
We are free.
We are free.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an extraordinary story, and one that I'm sure stays. But even as you're telling it, it's like you're back on the movie set.
Yeah.
You know, going through the motions of where you were, which is, and I presume it's has stayed with you ever since.
It hasn't. To be honest, I've spoken an awful lot more about it in the last few weeks than I have in 30 years.
Does it feel good talking about it?
It does. And I've done a little bit of hypnosis at the time. I had problems sleeping. It did have its effects, you know. But I think the thing is, my mom was a very positive person. We took it that we were really lucky. And I did have problems sleeping after. But I think the way an armed robbery was supposed to go, that went well. Sorry.
I like your humour. No, it's dark.
It is quite dark.
I don't have a heap of time, but I do want to mention the business that you've set up, because you were knocked down by a drunk driver 4.5 years
very
ago.
Very lucky, Ryan.
While we're listing off your catastrophes. you were badly hurt, but you were into caffeine and was it into it? You liked your coffee as a result.
I had a lot of caffeinated drinks, yes.
And you thought, well, hang on a second. I've got business running through my veins here. Let's turn this into a positive, which brings us neatly to these teas I have before me. Mm-hmm. Is this why you decided you want to decaffeinate a tea in your life? Just to say, calm,
yes,
hold.
Well, so basically I had that accident. And from that moment, I had four bulging discs. So I was kind of turning 40. I think people have a bit of a life moment of like, God, this is life. What do I, you know, lecturing for 15 years in strategy and entrepreneurship. And I'd always had a couple of businesses. I had a business when I was 16 selling candles. So it was in my blood. I was on highly caffeinated beverages, lots of sugar, working, had a 2-year-old and a 1-year-old. I was doing a PhD at night. Like everyone else, just go, 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 go. And coffee, 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 and, you know, all the beverages.
Yeah, so keeping you going.
Keeping going. And so basically I hated the taste of green tea. So I guess it's unusual. Maybe other people wouldn't do this. I just thought, you know what, I'm going to try and blend my own. So I blended my own teas. So I have an original blend, which is green tea, which is masked in. It's got 10 blends in it.
Each tea bag can be used a minimum 4 times.
And it's biodegradable.
This is fruitful. What's the word? Not fruitful. But
sustainable.
Sustainable, for sure. Yeah.
Reusable.
Yeah.
I have a sweet tea.
Yes.
Yeah, fruit. Well, no, it's very luxurious. It's a premium.
No, but
Brian,
it's
premium.
What you're saying is right. A sleep tea blend. I need that myself this week.
It increases your deep sleep from about 40 minutes to 2 hours.
I'll tell you about that tomorrow.
Yes. I don't like chamomile. So if you don't like chamomile, you love that. If you don't like green tea, you love the original blend. And turmeric for anti-inflammatory.
I've got
positiveness coming out of something.
Exactly.
Difficult.
That is your story. It's an epic. I'm sorry we didn't have more time, but Roz, it's been great to see you.
You too.
Congratulations, and the best of luck with the business and with the children, the family, and everything. And thanks for onwards and upwards, really.
Yes, exactly.
Roz Beer joining us live in studio this Wednesday morning. Bang on 9:30. What a lovely thing. Deirdre says, great memories. This is the sick tune has elicited a very emotional response from people. Like, great memories of my mother, says Deirdre, coming home from night duty as a nurse, and my dad presenting her with her tea on a tray, and all of us lined up in our pyjamas, washed and ready for the late. Great memories. Isn't that cute? And Aidan in Wexford says, I love your choice of music, and as for the original late theme, absolutely magic. Loving it all. Well, this is a great response. I'm so happy, and thank you for your generous responses on text. It's just tremendous. Louise Phillips, good morning.
Good morning,
it's
Ryan.
Very nice to meet you.
And it's great to meet you too.
You are a best-selling author from Dublin, and you have plenty to tell us about. I mentioned Louise Woodward and the case that we will get into in just a minute. But when a lot of people think of Ranelagh and Rathmines, particularly Ranelagh or Ranelagh, depending where you're from, and Dublin 6, they think big houses, big money,
yeah,
big posh backgrounds. But it wasn't always that way.
No, well, for myself, I mean, even now, if somebody said to me, where did you originally come from? I say, oh, somewhere between Ranelagh and Rathmines. And they have this illusion of a type of
la-di-da's about that, yeah.
But I think it was part of this social planning back in the 50s to incorporate social housing with very sort of upper class areas. In reality, they never mixed or combined. So I lived in a place called Mount Pleasant, which were tenements, and probably the furthest thing from Pleasant you could ever find. There are these big grey structures, three or four stories high, and people on the poverty line really that lived there. So
it doesn't sit, does it, with your image of
with
Mount
like
Pleasant
sort of, you know, nice cafes and everything, yeah, that you see today. But I mean, my husband is actually from Ranelagh. He's from a small terrace house, but he was the private house end.
Yeah.
And he was warned as a child, if he was going past Mount Pleasant tenements, to run and never have anything to do with anybody that
really?
Came from there. And so when we met, like in our late teens, it was like, I was warned about you.
It was straight out of Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly. It was difficult times, you know.
In what sense?
It was difficult in the sense that I suppose for there was four children at home, and my mum was quite protective. I think she was aware of the kind of negative social influences that could happen. So we would have spent a lot of our time just kind of playing directly outside the flat and not mixing necessarily with other children. But she was very entrepreneurial. Like, she used to do things like create swings indoors.
And
she used to be a swing that she used to put up at the bedroom that myself and my sister shared with our parents.
Yeah.
And we'd sit on the swing indoors, like this sad little person. But
you were a happy sad little person.
Yeah, we were happy. And so I think I was kind of aware at a very early age of the difference between people who have a certain quality of life, yeah, and people who didn't have a certain quality of life. And in that regard, I think that definitely framed me as an individual in relation to social awareness and that kind of a thing.
Of course.
Yeah, but it was, there was fun times, because even though we had very little, again, kind of talking about my mum again, she was very big into education and, you know, people learning as much as they possibly could. Nothing you ever learned ever went to waste or anything like that. So, like, we would sort of have been really into sort of the space program at the time and lots of things like that. Yeah. And I remember actually the time when the first moon landing, and talking to this friend of mine, Betty, who was my only friend in the flats, and telling her how exciting this was. And she hadn't even heard of it. And I was kind of going, how did she not know?
Yes.
And again, I think that was that sort of inkling in my head that actually some people don't know.
But you know what? I don't think that's necessarily, Louise, class-based, and certainly not even of the time. I think some people aren't curious.
Yeah,
I think some people just don't. Like, if we're in a business, you're as a writer, you know, and as media, as kind of media person, I'm gobbling it all up constantly, and I'll share it with my girls and go, oh, what do you think? What do you think? And you might find yourself saying, God, what did you think? Did you hear about this thing?
They I know.
Like the moon landing. Yeah. There's a moon?
There's a moon.
Some people just are so focused on the micro.
We were kind of a little bit odd, I suppose, as a family compared to sort of people around us. We did kind of quite I know a lot of people took registrations of cars and things like that, but we did all those sort of geeky things, you know, and
just randomly taking registrations.
Yeah, just writing a list of registrations. And
that's really geeky now. Yeah. It's kind of beautiful, actually.
Yeah, but you know, it kind of saved us too. So that was a really good part of it.
What about that palace of knowledge that requires no wallet, the library?
Yeah, I mean, again, one of my happiest memories is is time spent in the library. And again, like, because we didn't have money for books, and like I even say to people nowadays, do you know there's this great resource where they give you free books, you'll go.
And DVDs, and, I mean, I know they're a bit
exactly,
passing,
yeah.
but also so much more. Come on, sorry. You were saying.
So my mum used to bring us to the library in Rathmines, which was a beautiful building. And I remember back in that day when you were 12 and you made your confirmation, you actually got your adult library ticket.
Yeah, yeah.
And for me, it was like, oh my God, they're letting me free in the wild, you know. So I used to read everything and anything, which was great, because now, you know, when people are exposed to books, they're set in particular genres or type or young adult fiction. Whereas for me, it was just A to Z. And what am I going to find here?
Yeah. Everything. And is that, in terms of then 12 years old in school and everything, what did your background, do you think, prevent you from doing that you would have liked to have done?
Yeah, I think I had a sort of, maybe not as much confidence as I should have had, insofar as, you know, you kind of recognise that maybe you don't get certain things. And like I left school when I was just after what they used to call the intermediates, and which was 15. So at 15, I kind of went out into the adult world, because that was kind of the thing to do. You needed to go out and earn money and do all that kind of thing. But in some ways, that negative was actually a huge positive, because I was exposed to older people in the work environment quite young, which was, again, was very educational. And then I went back to study my Leaving Cert at night. And as a mature student, you know, you were in a class context that was slightly different, but also really exciting. And I had an English teacher in Mount Street when he actually taught us English and history. And he totally brought English alive for me.
You found the right teacher then.
Yeah, I mean, I remember sitting there in the class and the first night, and he said, this is the only night you're going to have to take down prescribed notes.
Great.
And I went, okay. And it started off with, you are a unique individual. Your experience with literature is going to be unique. There is no right or wrong answer.
What was his name?
Do you know what? I can't.
Tell me, you've forgotten his name. Oh, Captain, my captain.
No,
who is this? Who is this Robin Williams figure?
I'm really bad on names. And I
actually, somebody might help. What year were you in there?
Oh, gosh. Wait a minute. See, I have to go back. It'd be, probably around 80.
I've put you on the spot now, Louise. I'm being mean.
No, probably around 79.
Okay. And what where did you say it was?
Mount Street.
Mount Street.
Yeah.
We'll find him. A teacher that good will has to be remembered. And he kind of brought you into the world of
literature. I'm terrible on names.
That's okay. And dates. Yeah. But that's okay. We can that's why God gave us Google. We'll find him. But the bottom line is that got you into that world then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to just take a two or three steps back to your early childhood, if I may.
Okay, yeah.
Because it's informative to us as to where you went then with your most recent book. And that is to do with, and this is my question, was it to do with the nature of where you were brought up in the tenements in Ranelagh, or was it just life, the cruelty of the lottery of life, about your baby sister and your baby brother? Would you talk to me about them if it's not too difficult?
Yeah, I was age 4 when my mum went into Hollis Street to have my sister. And my memory of it as a child was waiting at home in the flat for my mum and my dad and my older brother to come back with the baby,
your
which was Monica.
Sister, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because like at that point, my mum had been in hospital for nearly 5 days, so she was due to come home. So like I was there waiting. Anyway, so
isn't it funny that you're 4 years, are you going to, can you share your age with us now, or is that the rudest
question?
Yeah,
no, I'm 59.
You're 59. And here you are in 2019, all these years later.
Yeah.
And you're getting emotional because it would be weird if you weren't.
Yeah.
Because you were waiting for this beautiful, freshly minted sister
exactly.
to come home.
Yeah.
Do you want to keep going or
I
can move on?
So So for me, I think at the time, like, it was obviously great excitement. What I hadn't realised was that my dad and my brother had gone in to collect my mum. But when they arrived in Hollis Street, instead of her being in the public ward, she'd been put into a private room.
Sure.
And that's when they discovered that Monica had died.
Had died. Okay. And do we know what had happened to her?
Well, we were always told growing up that, you know, she died of a cot death,
sure.
which is partly connected, obviously, to the current novel.
Yeah.
But after my mum passed away, I got Monica's death certificate. So she actually died of sepsis, which would have acted really, really fast. But what I didn't know that day was that my dad had gone into town with my brother, and because we couldn't afford a proper pram, they brought in a doll's pram.
A doll's pram?
Yeah.
And that's, that was meant to bring Monica home.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the three of them, my mum and dad and my brother and the doll's pram, all came home with the empty pram.
And you were four?
Yeah.
And you remember this so vividly, obviously.
Well, what I remember is my mum coming through the door, and she was like this sort of dark, shadowy figure, and she just kind of went straight to bed. I didn't understand.
She took to the bed, as the expression says.
And so, yeah, so I think at that point, I mean, obviously I knew something was wrong.
Of course.
And I'm sure it was explained to me, but I don't remember.
Yeah.
Just gradually over time, I began to realise. And then a year after that, my mum had another baby, but he was stillborn.
Okay.
So I'm the baby.
So you're the baby.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing? And it's just, I'm always struck by how a four-year-old you has that memory that's so profound and so etched into your heart and your soul, essentially.
Yeah.
That as you talk about it, the story's come to life again for you.
Yeah, and I think as I got older and I started to reflect on lots of aspects of it, I think, you know, I sort of grew up aware that the two children that followed me weren't as lucky as I was, you know. And so that in itself sort of kind of tells you to kind of grab life and to kind of do what you can.
I understand. I like the sound of your mum.
She's great.
Like that swing, the library, the education, the moon landings. Like she was a giver of knowledge. She was a teacher.
She was almost great.
Yeah.
I mean, I think she was kind of an early feminist. Like before,
great. Like
we kind of came along like steps to stairs. She used to work in the Ivy Markets, and then she opened a shop that sold shoes. And I think she would have been far more successful business-wise than my dad ever was.
You haven't mentioned your dad necessarily yet.
Yeah. He's like, he kind of... When I think about him, like I loved him a lot, but when I think about him, he was sort of one of those men that were trapped in the way he was supposed to behave back then, you know. So like he told my mum she had to give up work because now there was children and all that.
Wait a minute. What an interesting turn of phrase. He was trapped in the way he was meant to behave.
Yeah.
Do you feel that there was a progressive man trapped in the mores of his time?
Yeah. Like I remember when we had our children, so he was quite happy to push the buggy with the grandchildren.
Really? He was ahead of his time.
Yeah, but he never pushed a pram like I was, according to my mum anyway, back in the day.
Isn't
so
that funny?
It was like, you know, he conformed to this sort of male
type.
Yeah.
You had your own children ultimately. How many do you have?
Yeah, three.
Three children. And I suppose as we all do when we become parents, we reflect on, God, so this is what they did.
Yeah.
And as you hit milestones in your life, you think, God, so they would have been this age. Go, oh, right, okay. You know, it's a strange thing. And I'm sure you thought about your folks a lot when you had your own children.
Yeah, I think, it's not that I can be fully sure, but I'm pretty sure that after Monica and then my brother who was stillborn, I definitely think my mum went into a form of postnatal depression.
Sure.
And I had that with each of the three children as well. So it in a way, I suppose I had this kind of unique position through the looking glass that I remember being a child in that situation with a parent that felt lost. And then I remember kind of feeling a little bit lost
of course.
The parent.
Yeah, no, I understand that. And you're an emotional fish, which is really lovely. I can sense a real kindness from you. And I suppose that probably then, that's why I'm very happy with your success, because I think it's from the heart.
Thank you.
And you've earned it. And I think your mother would particularly be so proud of you.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And as I say that, I'm thinking about then you as a young mum, like watching the news as we all did that time when this young nanny, the long brown hair, little cold, some might say, in court. They had hired, these American people had hired what they thought was like almost a Mary Poppins figure, English, proper, straight, comes along to look after the children. And the baby died on her watch.
Exactly.
Could you remind us the little...
Yeah, the trial was televised in 1997.
Yes, and Louise Woodward, yes.
Yeah, Louise Woodward. And at that point, like, I was a young mum. And I remember being kind of so fascinated with the trial, apart from the whole emotional subject matter, which was huge. But it was like... Even sort of with the O.J. Simpson trial,
yeah,
this whole thing about
the thing,
it was like a
big
drama.
Yeah.
And I was drawn to Louise Woodward because she was this sort of aloof figure, and I thought, God, it's so hard to know whether she's innocent or guilty.
Yes.
And although at the time I wasn't writing, I definitely feel like, as kind of crime writers go, we tend to love these grey areas of where is the truth.
The lack of certainty
is what
drives the thriller.
Exactly,
right.
Exactly. So I suppose it was the combination of one, you know, that just huge interest in the whole format of the trial, and then this young girl who could potentially be sent away for the rest of her life for something that she may not have done.
Yeah, and there, and you got thinking. Did you think then about your own mother's experience with your brother and sister and loss of life and young...
Well, not initially at that point, but after a few years after that, my mum passed away. And as children often do, you reflect on your parents and you start to see things that maybe you were always aware of them, but they kind of become more crystallised in your mind.
Yes.
And I know when my mum died, it was probably the first time, as I've said, I really experienced true heartbreak, because
sure,
I could actually feel the kind of pain of it.
Instant.
And I thought about her life, and I suppose about my sister and my brother, and how hard it must have been for her. And actually, one of the things in the book that kind of said a couple of times is this expression, it's kind of okay to be fragile, it's okay to be strong.
Mm.
You know, there's times we're fragile, there's times we're strong, and both are fine.
And that makes us human, doesn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly. Yeah.
The book is called The Hiding Game.
Yes.
Congratulations to you, Louise.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming to see us today.
Yeah.
The first of many encounters, I hope.
Hopefully so.
And I think it's been a real pleasure to say hello to you. Thanks for your candour. Appreciate it.
Okay.
And I think you probably told a story that a lot of people will recognise and take some comfort from, actually. And good luck with it all.
Okay.
Thank you
so much.
Louise
Thank
Phillips.
You.
The book is called The Hiding Game. That's one you're going to need for your shelf in the coming weeks, for sure, as the autumn trickles in, as the leaves fall. Could that teacher be Con Harvey or Jim Cook? Mr. Harvey or Mr. Cook, anything ringing a bell there? Not yet.
Not yet.
We'll go again. 51551. Louise Phillips, an absolute... Could it be Miss Seamus Purcell?
No.
Purcell.
No.
Nothing got shaken there. Okay,
no.
we'll get there again. By God, we'll get there.
Okay.
It's 12 minutes to 10. Back in a moment.
The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1.
All right, Peter Andre, welcome to the programme. It's great to see you.
You look a million bucks. Or your eyes.
Yeah, let's say your eyes.
Let's
reduces
say your
it
eyes.
A little bit. It's probably more. How are you? It's been great to see. It's great to see you.
Fantastic, thank you. And you?
Yeah, really good. You're back in Ireland because you're going to get taken stuck into Grease the musical.
Absolutely. I think because I'm from Cyprus, they just automatically said, "Would you like to do Grease?" I wasn't quite sure they meant the musical. No, I was. It's wonderful. It's going to be great.
You're back. We'll talk about that in a second. But your background is Greek Cypriot parents, born in Harrow, emigrated to Australia. You're the United Nations.
I am the United Nations, and I plan to bring peace. The thing is, it's very strange for me because when I'm in Australia, I always get told, "Oh, look at you sounding English," all the time. They call me a pom.
And then you come over here.
And then
here.
When I come here and it's like, "Oh, you're an Aussie." Difference is the Brits love you sounding like an Aussie.
Yeah.
The Aussies aren't so sure they want you to sound like a Brit. Although we are all Brits. No, they're lovely over there.
It's because your folks had a big wedding anniversary not so long ago.
64 years, yeah.
Massive. Mm. Massive. And they're still talking and happy.
No, they're not necessarily talking, but they're happy. Probably because they're not talking.
They're cohabiting.
No, they're great. And, you know, they've taught us so much. So hopefully we're doing them proud as a family.
I was interested to read about you that your dad was tough love and your mum was cuddle love.
Absolutely.
What does the tough love, where did that come from? Was it kind of religious, was it? Or
I think it's a mixture of both religion and
tradition.
Yeah.
And when you mix the two together and they don't exactly agree with each other, it's tough. I mean, so mum and dad, very devout Christians, but they also had the Greek traditions, which sometimes don't always
mix.
Yeah. Because so for example, just to give you an example, in a Christian belief, it might be if you meet another Christian, you can have a great life together.
Sure.
But then in the Greek tradition, it's like if you meet another Greek, you could have a great time together. What if that Greek's not Christian? Then we're in trouble.
Yeah.
So it's like it was finding needles in a haystack. It was that sort of thing. But no, they really brought us up with so much love, and everything that they did, even Dad with his strictness, it was all out of love.
Yeah.
But I eventually got to tell Dad I love him at 31 years old I was.
Do you feel that was late?
Well,
to tell your dad that
it was too early, and I'll tell you why.
Tell me, yeah.
Because I didn't have the guts to say to Dad, I love you. Mum, I'd always say I love you, but Dad is, you know. So I finally built up the courage. I was in England on the phone talking to Dad in Australia, and I said, I love you, Dad. And he went, yes, we are all very fond of you too. And that was,
and I was, it was on his time, right?
I was, yeah. So now he says it.
Does he?
But he's 86. Yeah. They're such wonderful parents. They really are.
I think that the parents of your dad's generation find it easier to be more demonstrative towards the grandchildren than their own children.
Well, that is 100% true, because my dad actually hugs my children.
He actually hugs them?
I'm like, Dad, what about me? Well, you're a grown man now, so, you know. Good luck with that. I'm not sure I'm doing his accent.
That sounds good. I mean, he's your dad. I can't judge.
He's a great guy. Yeah. If you ever met him, he would just... Yeah. He's such a nice man. Yeah, but they are a good example.
You joke about being called a pom in the UK, but you got fierce abuse, kind of pretty, essentially racist bullying as a kid. And I'm always curious to know, but you've got a very positive demeanour in life. I met you about 10 years ago. I see on TV. I just don't see anger, and I don't see a great amount of pain. But you were called everything under the sun, essentially. Mm. You were beaten up and stones thrown at you and all that kind of. How do you withstand that and stay positive and strong?
Well, that's an excellent question, because when... So just to give a quick background to people listening that might not know. So I was a Greek kid with a English, strong English accent, curly hair, much bigger nose than all the other kids. And here I was in this paradise with these beautiful blonde-haired, blue-eyed Aussie kids.
Aryan race, yeah.
And I couldn't have stood out more. And it was a very racist time. But here's the thing. Yes, we got a lot of abuse from the kids calling us terms that I don't know if I should say on radio. But then the teachers were the same. Teachers would say things that I couldn't believe. When I went to a teacher and he said the derogatory things he said.
Say what he said, because...
Okay.
I think it just makes it more real.
They used to call us greasy wogs. So wog in Australia is the term for... Greeks, Italians, Lebanese, you know, sort of people of the Adriatic, Mediterranean.
Gotcha. And the teacher called you this?
Well, I walked into the class and I said, oh, hello, sir. And he said, oh, you're that greasy wog that's coming in my class. He said, I've never had a greasy wog in my class. So you're going to sit in the corner and you're going to face the wall. And literally I thought, well, I can't talk to the teachers about this. I can't talk to the kids at school about this. Can't talk to my parents, because they brought us to Australia wanting a better life. Now, I just want to make it perfectly clear. I love Australia with all my heart.
Yeah, you're not having a go
at Australia. And actually, funny enough, that teacher years later, I bumped into him.
Yeah.
And I'd had this amazing success in Australia. And he saw me and he didn't know how I'd react. And I gave him a massive hug. And he said, mate, I'm so sorry. And do you know what I said to him? I said, sir, I still called him sir.
Yeah, your teacher.
I said, mate, don't be silly. That's how it was. I get it.
Yeah.
You're not like that now. The kids that were bullying at school weren't like that, because it became very multicultural. Mm.
They evolved.
Yeah, and I think sometimes you kind of want to blame things in the past and go, oh, they did this. But actually, they probably didn't know any better. And I know it sounds terrible. It sounds strange to say that, but they didn't know any better and now they know better. Yeah.
Well, the kids aren't going to be greatly improved if the teacher is doing that.
No, you know it was a tough time, and I used to be very scared. And so I came back to England, and well, I had success in Australia first, but touring with Madonna and all those wonderful things. And then things changed, and a lot of those bullies become your friends, which is, and I hold no grudges. And the reason I'm positive, which is what the question you asked me, is because eventually when I went through a breakdown and went through therapy and all that, I realized that actually, forgiveness, all the things my mum and dad told us, you know, find the good in people, all these things, it just came to the surface. And I love everybody. And I know it sounds bizarre. It's probably because I'm on my second espresso. But helps. I do love everybody.
But it's a great attitude. And actually, I think that sort of positivity removed the toxins that would otherwise fester. When you are watching the Leaving Neverland documentary, there you were, the Michael Jackson controversy. You were, what, 11 years old in the back? You came sort of second or something in that competition.
I know. Can you actually believe that? I didn't know that Wade Robson, the 5-year-old child, was the kid that I was with that day.
Did you know?
And I remember seeing this kid. You were going to ask me a question, though. I should let you ask me first.
Please, go. You go ahead.
Well, you see, so there was a Michael Jackson dance competition. I was 11 and I'd won my heat and I'd won the state, and now we were going for the chance to meet Michael Jackson. Mm. And at the time, Michael Jackson was nobody could even get close. So I was entering this competition. You had to be 7 years old to enter.
Yes.
Here I was in this competition thinking I did well, and this 5-year-old kid called Wade Robson came out, and he was just the coolest little kid you'd ever seen. And we all said, oh my gosh, if this kid doesn't win it, I mean, he's gonna win it. But he shouldn't win it because he's 5.
Yeah.
And you've got to be 7. But the host turned around and said, if I don't let you win this, there's gonna be mayhem in here. So he won, and I was devastated. Devastated, because the next night I went and saw Michael Jackson live, and so did Wade, and then the night after that, when Stevie Wonder was on stage, Wade's on stage with Michael Jackson. I mean, it was like you know.
Sliding doors in some ways.
I'm a bit sad, though, because I have a very sort of mixed view on this whole thing. Do you mind me giving...
I'd love to know what you think, because just to remind people, so Wade Robson then went on to say that Jackson sexually abused him, and the Jackson family said, no, he didn't. And the documentary suggests that it was all very peculiar. What's your... You were kind of close to it all. What do you make of it now?
The thing is for me is that it's very hard. First of all, if anything's ever happened to somebody in a bad way, their voices need to be heard.
Yes.
But then on the flip side, if something didn't happen... And I look at it that the FBI did investigate him for 10 years and found nothing, and he was acquitted of all counts. So what I'm saying is that I'm not saying a crime has never been committed. Yeah. What I am saying is very difficult to make someone guilty when based on accusation alone. And I think putting that aside, we've got to separate the music.
Can you do that? Can you know when you think that he paid off some kids to say, okay, there's you just stay quiet, we'll drop the case or whatever, and some people might imply a certain amount of guilt
absolutely.
In that, which is implication, by the way, isn't a verdict. But do you think that we could should still be hearing Jackson on the radio?
I will tell you why I think we should.
Yeah, okay.
Because Michael Jackson, didn't write all his songs anyway. So let's put Michael Jackson aside. You've got Rod Temperton, you've got Quincy Jones, you've got Paul McCartney that sung with him, Mick Jagger, some of the greatest songs written by Sada Garrett. Stevie Wonder wrote some of Michael Jackson's songs. Now, if we stop listening to that, we tarnish all of these artists. For me, I pray that he never did anything like that.
Yes.
I will never know.
Do you think he's innocent, essentially?
I find it... gosh, how do I say this? How can I... I can only give my opinion on what I see so far, and I pray it isn't true. That's not the question you've just asked me.
I get the sense that you feel that he's more innocent than he is guilty.
I just think that I feel that he is... Okay. Let me give you another example. But when you see somebody like an R. Kelly situation, there's video footage, there's evidence. And I just think with Michael Jackson, over years of this alleged stuff, surely there will be some sort of evidence. Yes, some of the things about the trials and the paying off and all that, but I mean, there's not video footage, there's no photos. I'm just saying, should there be something?
Okay, well, leave it on that question. Yeah. I want to come back to you. I think we were talking about brothers earlier on, about the Johnson brothers falling out in the UK yesterday, and Cain and Abel. And a nice story about brothers. Is Chris your brother, the music?
Yeah,
the guy
who
plays all the instruments.
Musician.
So he kind of saw in you this talent and said, no, come on, Peter, you can do this. And, and you know, I played Mysterious Girl there earlier on. What does Mysterious Girl do for you now? Does it kind of bring you out in a rash, or does it make you grin with happiness? Or
well, I think it makes me grin with happiness now, because all you have to do is, you don't have to sing it.
People love it.
No, the great thing is, it's one of those songs on stage where you're like, microphone. Well, I'll bow this one out. Here's the microphone, guys. Go for it. I'm not going to lie. I'm so grateful for that song.
Yes.
But there is always that thing in your mind of like, why didn't I write that classic ballad that ended up being the big hit? Where, you know, because we wrote some great songs with some great writers, and then Mysterious Girl was kind of the easy, not easy one to write, but it was the more fun one to write. Yeah. But actually, that has been a blessing all the way through, because every summer it's a hit.
Yes. So Let It Go, that's what it did. And it's been number one twice.
We tour after 25 years. It's ridiculous.
So you became extremely famous, obviously, in Australia and then the UK, and you came on to kind of Art Radars here in Ireland, and you got this big fan base, and it's all enormous. You know, tonight, for example, on our Late Late Show, I have three people who went into the Love Island situation, reality TV show, with, you know, one with 3,000 followers, one with 600 maybe, and the other with 2,000. They were handed their phones back after X amount of time, 3.4 million, 5.1. It's the immediacy of it.
Mm.
They're in for a land. Good people, but they need to be minded.
Mm.
Does it get too big? Did it get too big for you? Is that what happened to you? Or
mine stemmed from the racism at school, and then the... Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, because you were attacked at one stage.
Yeah.
A knife attack.
Was a different kind of thing. That wasn't racism. So imagine going through the racism. Finally come through.
Yeah.
Then these Aussie kids ended up being so awesome and like my friends.
Yeah.
And I forgave, like, of course it was the past. Then I went through the stage of a lot of ethnic gangs in Sydney. I don't know if you know about this, but it's still very strong. A lot of violence within the ethnic gangs within themselves.
Okay.
So this was a different situation. I had a knife pulled on me. Hear this for a story.
Sure.
Imagine you get a knife pulled on you. You have no idea why. You're pushed into a bathroom. There are all this gang are around you, threatening you, constantly calling you on your phone, saying, you know, by the way, they were bricks, these phones back then, you know, telling you what they're going to do to you. And I always wondered why. And apparently this all stemmed from a girl that wanted to come to the concert. Her boyfriend didn't like it. He hit her. Another gang beat him up. He ended up in hospital. And it's my fault.
It's your fault.
And it just was spiraled. Everywhere I'd go, there'd be trouble. And I thought, I'm not going out to clubs anymore. I stopped going to nightclubs.
Yeah.
And then I sort of harbored it inside for years, and then it all just came crashing down when I was 10 years later. Things were going really well, and I just for some reason, anxiety, panic, everything you could fear just came.
And had you become a dad at that point, or was?
No, it was before I became a dad, yeah.
Because you became a dad with Katie Price. I'm not going to talk to you about that, because you want to protect your children in that regard and that relationship. Is that right? Because
but the reason I don't is because I never want to say I tend to steer from that subject, not because I'm in any way being disrespectful or anything. I just feel that, you know, I'm married. I've got,
and do you know what? I totally understand that. So that's why I'm going to move on to ask you that.
Thank you.
You what we would say, you went local with essentially an Irish girl called McDonough over in Australia. Is that right? In England?
No. What it was her father, who's a urologist, operated on my kidney.
Yes.
How bizarre is this?
And
I met his daughter through him, which proves...
You offered him tickets for your gig.
Yeah.
And he said, well, I'll give them to my daughter.
Yeah, and I'm sure his daughter didn't want to go either. But what happened was, there's no love without pain, by the way, because the operation ended up leading me to love. But no, I said, can I do something for you? Because he really helped me. And he said, give me some tickets for the show and I'll send my family. So the family came.
Mm.
I met the family, lovely. We all became friends for 2 years.
Oh.
Yeah, we were all friends, both our families. The kids knew Auntie Emily. We call everyone auntie and uncle in our culture. So Auntie Emily, Dr. Rue, and we all became friends. And then 2 years later, I thought, oh my gosh, I've got feelings. Dr. Rue's going to kill me. He's going to wish he did a different operation on me. What do I say to him? And I asked him, you know, I've got feelings. And he said, do you think I haven't noticed that both of you should be together? And he gave me his full blessing. And then I asked Emily. Thankfully, she said yes. And the rest is history.
How many children do you have together?
Two children.
How old are they?
Five and two and a half. You got me there.
Sorry, yeah, that's okay.
Sorry, I've got four children. That's
of why. Course you do. And it's lovely because you have a blended family. It's a modern family. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful thing. And I want to go back to one thing about the fame thing when it all mm-hmm. came back. Because sometimes with the pad, they often say that generationally it's really important now that our children, because we're the same age, and our kids should be, you know, they're better at talking and opening up in a way that we weren't mm-hmm. taught, I think. Mm-hmm. And ultimately then when you did decide, right, there's something wrong, you were having, what, 20 panic attacks a day at one point? And they sound terrifying, panic attacks.
There must be people listening to this that have been through this, and it's something you can't explain until you go through. It's very real.
Awful. You feel them coming down the track?
Oh, yeah. It's you. No matter what anyone tells you, you think at that moment, this is it. Am I even going to get through this attack? So going through those 20 times a day, and it was that much. I was bedridden for a long time. Mum and Dad couldn't understand. I kept telling them I had the flu. I couldn't think of what to tell them. They're old generation.
Yeah.
Oh, you go eat some lamb, you'll be fine. No problem. Right? So I had to try to explain to them that I couldn't eat. I was shaking all the time. Yeah. Panicking, became social phobic, fear of heights, all this. It manifested itself.
This was the bullying. This was the knife attack. This was the fame, the attention. Was it all of the above?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've always looked at the fame. Well, I don't know if fame's the right word, but the attention and all that as a positive, because as a kid, that's all I wanted was to be accepted. So when I finally became accepted, that's why I'm always smiling, because people are nice to me and I'm thinking, geez, this is fantastic. You know, people are so nice to me. I'm 46 years old and I've got people coming up going, hey, Pete, how are you? And that's all I ever wanted, you know?
You seem content. And I suspect, you know, I think contentment is the best target for people in life. Happiness is mad. Mm. It's like having Christmas every day. The human condition doesn't allow for happiness constantly. It'd be weird if you were. But contentment is a pretty good place to be.
I have to say that I'm not going to lie, that therapy and medication... And I went through a lot of therapy, nearly 10 years. Right. But what it did for me, and the medication helped, but on its own medication doesn't work because you need to get to the root of the problem. But anyway, what it did for me was once I came through, I remember literally praying, saying, if I can get through this, I will never take anything for granted again. I remember being... literally on my knees begging.
Yeah.
And so when things turned around and I started to see things bright again, I was like, I'm never taking this for granted
again. I can see clearly now the rain.
Yeah, I was a bit cocky in the early days.
That's probably, you have to be a bit.
And so that's why people didn't, you know, they weren't too much of a fan in the early
days. Oh, listen, I can't tell you, the text machine has gone into meltdown of, there's a lot of love for you in Ireland.
Oh, that's so honest nice. To goodness, I love you guys.
It says a text, it's such a pity that all successful artists aren't as humble and so lovely as Peter. You're so lovely, Peter. Peter is lovely. He's just great, says Liz. tell Peter he was definitely dealt a good card in the looks department. Credit where it's due.
Fungi
the Dolphin sends him a kiss from Siobhan and Kerry. Long story, I tell you about that later. And saw Peter and his beautiful children on Good Morning with Lorraine doing his wonderful cooking. Annette from Donabate, give him a big kiss from me. Well, I'll give you a metaphorical kiss from Kate.
Do I tell them that I wasn't live this morning because I'm here? Yes. It was live.
We're the live bit. Yes.
Sorry. But thank you very, very much.
I always knew Peter, who Peter Ronde was, but God, he sounds like such a lovely man. And it's all an act. He came in here miserable. You want to see him. He hates Ireland. Obviously not. You're in, you're going to be Teen Angel in Greece. I mean, it's an iconic musical. Why are you laughing at that?
Well, because I'm neither a teen nor an angel. That's why.
Is it true that you don't like taking your T-shirt off on the beach now because you're self-conscious? Look at you.
I have never.
You're a disgrace.
You ask my wife. She's like, why won't you just... I said, no. I'll by the pool, but when there's people around, I just not like that, which is the opposite to what you
You would think.
What I've built my whole sort of...
But I have an excuse. You have no excuse. Like, why, but you don't,
Because you don't know.
Try and be assertive. It's not, you're not vain, you're not, you're
self-conscious. No, I don't, I must be self-conscious, maybe subconsciously, if that makes sense.
That's okay, we'll take that, we'll take that. I met Peter in a hotel restaurant, says John, in Melbourne 20 years ago.
Oh, wow.
When he sent his brother out to get a CD for my young son at the time, he then came over to the table, chatted with my boss and myself about his father's friends in Ireland for half an hour. A gentleman, and I never forgot it.
Oh, wow.
It's great.
Thank you.
You're going to be sharing the role, by the way, of Teenager with Samantha Mumba, who's a great star here in this country. And
she's great.
You are going to be at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre from the 17th to the 28th of September, which is just around the corner. BordGáisEnergyTheatre.ie for more information. Peter, it's just so good to see you. And I'm glad that life dealt you the hand you deserved. And I wish you Emily
mate.
And the gang, all the children, all the very, very best. Good luck in your stay in Dublin. I hope you have a good time around here.
It's wonderful. And good luck tonight.
Thank you very
for
much.
For you.
Yeah. Come and join us some evening.
Thank you all so much for having me.
Thanks, Peter. Really great to talk to you live in studio this morning. Peter Andre, the time now is 7 minutes to 10 o'clock.